26-10. This is one that I learned the hard way. Epically hard way. 26-10. Yes. Proverbs first and then numbers. Cassie, how long have we been doing this? That white cup in front of you, pick that up, bring it to your lips. Like an archer who wounds everyone. What type of archer is an archer who wounds everyone? A really bad archer, right? And that is likened to someone who hires a fool or he who passes by. The idea is you're putting a deadly weapon into the hands of somebody who is not trained, who is not equipped, who is not mature enough, who is not able to handle the tool that they have and understand the resources at their disposal and what they can do. It's likened to employing someone or bringing someone into a leadership position that does not have the maturity, the street cred, the background, whatever it is to do what they're doing. Okay, any of you that are in church work have felt this tension, or you're going to. Okay, one of the number one problems that churches deal with that never goes away are there are too many people and too few leaders. So you're always wrestling with where is the line of leadership? Like, do you need to be like a half step behind Jesus and almost can walk on water to be a leader in the church, right? To lead a small group or a couples ministry or to lead WSM students or to hang out with middle school kids? Is that the line? Or is it like, hey, can we just make sure that you're professing Christ as opposed to Baal or whomever and you're good, right? So where is the line of leadership, right? As I was coming right out of seminary, I took a job at a church in Dallas at an amazing church called Watermark. And myself and three other guys were in charge of all the small groups in the church. So we had close to 2,000 people, and it was our job to make sure that everyone in the body was in a life group, right? Same value that's here at the Well. We talk about it consistently, and that was our heart, right? So we were constantly up against this battle of we have these people whose hearts are to get into groups, but we didn't have enough seasoned leaders, right? So we kind of picked the low-hanging fruit, and we put those folks as leaders and trained them as best we could and got them going. And then every Sunday, we would get a barrage of people that were signing up for groups. We thought, man, this is the greatest problem ever, right? Well, we had this women's group that says, hey, we want to meet, and these gals were trying to get in community, and we were looking for leaders. And we would do due diligence. Like, we would find a gal that would say, hey, I want to lead. And we'd say, great. So we would take whomever it was, we would take them out to lunch or coffee with all of our staff, and we would interview them and just talk to them. Like, give me a feel for, like, man, did you trust Christ yesterday? Like, are you seasoned in your walk? And we would talk to them about their testimony and what it means to walk with Christ and, like, all those things, right? So we took this gal out, myself, my boss, and the other community pastor. We had lunch, and we talked to this gal. I'm like, she's awesome. We all left lunch thinking this gal's legit. She loves the Lord. She's phenomenal, right? So we put her in a leadership position over, like, it was like 16 single women, and she was this single gal slightly older than the rest of them, right? And then we get a call a couple months into this group, and we find out that the gal that we put in leadership was in an active homosexual relationship, and she had, as a result, gotten into this group so that she could meet other gals, and she had brought other girls who were less mature in their faith and weren't quite sure where they lined up on the issue or were struggling with this, and had now developed a relationship with one of the gals in the group. And then she is a leader, and this other gal, now we're in a homosexual relationship. We were like, oh my gosh. And we were responsible for that. So we had to go into the group, talk to this gal, right? And then pull her aside and say, hey, we love you, but we see scripture differently in this area. This is not something that's okay. And we need to walk you kind of through this process. But in the meantime, we need to pull you out of the leadership position that you've been in this group. And then we had to sit down with the rest of the group and tell the group why we were removing this gal from leadership, right? Not that we hate her, we're not going to be Facebook friends anymore, but we needed to shepherd her through this process. And then we had to deal with the aftermath and the pain and the hurt and the tears and the confusion biblically over what they had been taught by this gal and then what the church was teaching and where to line up and then the emotional baggage that went with that. And it was just the biggest it was a mess, right? And it took literally months, if not years, to work some of that out, to get some of those gals replaced, to deal with the baggage that was a part of that and the pain that had been caused. And I realized in the midst of this was a lesson that we didn't apply. We were so pressed for leaders that we probably pulled the trigger on that decision quicker than we would have had we had plenty of leaders. We would have stuck that gal in a group with a seasoned leader, let her apprentice or be shadowed by, you know, by another leader for months and, you know, say, hey, tell me about this gal. How is she doing? What are you seeing in her? That sort of thing. But we were forced into it. And one of the lessons that I learned in the midst of this was this. And the idea is, in a church and in any company for that matter, you are far better off dealing with the problems of too few leaders than you are dealing with the problems of bad leaders or unqualified or like an archer who wounds everybody, right? It had been much easier to tell those 10 gals, hey, or 16 gals, I'm sorry, we don't have a leader for you right now. We're terribly apologetic. We would love for you guys to be in community, but we're not going to stick you in a group that ultimately could end up doing damage. And that's what happened in this group. So learn from Uncle Mikey. That was a poor leadership decision in my tenure. I have not done that since, but learn the hard way, okay? You guys are going to be put in positions where you're going to be called to evaluate talent, right? Evaluate people, evaluate character, evaluate gifting. And you're going to have to choose whether or not sometimes people are ready to go or not. And you're going to swing and miss on some, and you'll hit home runs on others. But this is a tricky line to figure out. At what point is somebody qualified to go into leadership? And at the 10, 11, 12 tenure that the well has, we have moved that bar all over the map, trying to figure out what's appropriate, what does God want, and what would honor him. So, but something to think about, all right? You want to be careful about the type of people that you put in leadership. Paul warns Timothy about laying hands on elders too quickly, lest you share in the blame of what happens if you put someone in a significant place of leadership. A life group leader is one thing, but an elder is another, and then have to deal with the ramifications of a bad elder, okay? So, thoughts on that before we back into Numbers. Numbers 22 is where we finished last week. Let me pray for us this morning, and then we will dive back into our boy Balaam and Balak and Moab and Chemosh and Baal Peor and all kinds of fun stuff that you've never read. So this will be the best sermon on Numbers you've ever heard. I guarantee it. It'll be the only sermon on Numbers you've ever heard, but that's all right. God, thanks for today, and thanks for your word, and thanks for the chance to continue to study. And Lord, as we look at the Israelites and the tail end of their time in the wilderness, the way you have used them, the way you have developed and shaped and molded and even disciplined them at times. Lord, I pray that we would continue to be cognizant of these things, that we would learn from them, that we would see kind of their actions and put our lives as a mirror in front of theirs and see how we measure up. Lord, would we continue to be moldable and teachable by you? Would our hearts be sensitive to the moving of the Spirit in our lives? And Lord, will we not err maybe in some of the ways that these men and women did back in their day and age? So teach us this morning. We love you. In Christ's name, amen. All right. So we are again dealing with now the new generation, right? We haven't officially kind of broken that mark. We'll get there in chapter 26 as we start numbering the new generation. But God has now promised to say, hey, I am killing off the old generation because of their sin, because of their hardness of heart. We are going to deal with all of them. Okay, so we're seeing a ton of deaths happen from Numbers, 10 and beyond. We've seen the rebellion. We've seen all kinds of things with the old generation, and they are headed south. Okay, and then last week, we met a guy by the name of Balaam, right? We saw a couple battles prior to this with Moab that Israel tried to kind of avoid, but they're coming. Israel had to take a long way around Edom in the south. In fact, instead of talking about it, I'll show you the map. Tech booth, TV card, that's what I want. Maybe? Jeez. Fabulous. All right. So, look at that. Beautiful. Okay. So, down south, there's a Dead Sea at the bottom. Okay, we see the battles that are taking place. The Amorite battles with Sihon and Og we saw last week. Sihon and Og were the big, strong, tough guys, the Shaquille O'Neal, giants in the land. So Israel took them down, and now we're dealing with them with Moab. Okay, so these are the Moab Mountains directly across from the Jordan River on the east side where you see Gilead. That is the Moab Mountains. So the Moabites are in that area. Let me see if I can get a better map. Yeah, this one's good. So you see Edom at the bottom there, and then Moab kind of stretching from the whole Dead Sea area. Okay, so we're about to deal with those folks. So Israel has come off of two pretty significant battles, and then the king of Moab realizes, man, the same fate that with Sihon and Og is coming my way too if I don't do something. So he grabs a guy named Balaam, right? This for-hire prophet in the land, and he says, man, instead of fighting these guys directly, let's fight them indirectly. Let's see if I can get you to curse this group of people. Okay, so we'll find more about Balaam's backstory here in a bit, but that's kind of where we're at in the journey of chapter 22. Balak, the king of Moab, grabs this guy, and now they're going to try to prophesy. And he promised, hey, I'll give you honor, I'll give you wealth, I'll cut you a check, whatever you need. I am not unable to honor you greatly and richly. And that's kind of where we left off in the story. In 23 now, we're going to see the beginning of this process of Balaam attempting to curse the nation of Israel on Balak's behalf, and we're going to see how God responds to that. Now, what have we seen about Balaam so far? What have you observed regarding his character, whose team he's on, that sort of thing? Yeah, so he's certainly a guy that knows the God of Israel, okay? And he said that several times. Like, hey, I can only say what the God of Israel puts in my mouth, right? So if you want something different, that's all I got, okay? What else? Yeah, so he's a for-hire guy. He's being paid to do what he does. So it makes you kind of scratch your head and go, something's going on, right? Like, it just seems a little bit awkward, some of the language that's used to describe this guy. He seems to be on Team God, but we're gonna see. Okay, so just keep those thoughts in the back of your mind as we read more about Balaam. Okay, 23 verse 1. This is we're gonna see four rounds basically with Balaam and Balak and their desire to curse the people. This is round one. Okay, 23:1. Pick up there. All right, so let me kind of back up and kind of walk you through where they're at. After these battles, Israel is camped right here in the plains of Moab. So Jordan River is here, and they're just on the east side of the Jordan. They're entering into the land. They are in a low spot, in a plain, and all around them are these tall mountains. Mount Pisgah, by the way, is about right here. You'll see that later. This is where Moses is ultimately going to die. So they head up the hill, and now Balaam and Balak are overlooking the entire encampment of Israel from up on high. And now they're going to offer sacrifices. You can see that. Bulls, seven altars that are built. This is a big, elaborate ordeal that Balaam says, this is what we're going to need to do to curse this people. Okay? Verse 3, Balaam says to Balak, stand beside your burnt offering. I will go. Perhaps the Lord will come to meet me. And whatever he shows me, I will tell you. So he went to a bare hill. So Balaam now meets with God and says, Lord, give me a word. What do you want me to take back now to Balak? Whatever you say to me, I will say to him. Okay, verse 4, God met Balaam and he said to him, I have set up seven altars. I have offered a bull and a ram on each altar, right? What is that? Why are they doing this? Why would Balaam be offering altars and bulls? What does that sound like? So, huh? Yeah, it sounds like maybe atonement, but it's where have we seen this before? Is this consistent with how God wants his people to interact? Yeah, it's like the book of Leviticus, right? So there's a hint of godliness about it, right? This is consistent with what we've seen. So he's not outside the boundaries of maybe what God would want. Do you have a thought? Yeah, there's an interesting distinction there. So we're going to see people outside of the tribe of Levi build altars and do stuff like that. That's not so much frowned upon as offering sacrifices within the tabernacle or within the temple. So we'll see David do this. Solomon's going to do this to give an offering and to give things to God outside of the context of the tabernacle. Presumably was okay. It seems fine. So God is, in fact, pleased by that based on what we see in the other text. Okay, but it's not within the context of atonement, if you will. These are more of a a thanksgiving and a submission to God, saying you're in control, that type of attitude, okay? So you see this kind of attitude with Balaam, okay? Lord, now in verse 5, put a word in Balaam's mouth and said, return to Balak, and you're going to say this, okay? And here's the this that he says now in verse 7 regarding Israel to Balak. So somebody pick up there in verse 7. All right, so this was Balak's request. He says, okay, this is what you want me to do, to curse Israel, to curse Jacob's people, or God's people, Jacob. Okay, keep rolling.
How can I curse whom God has not cursed? How can I denounce whom the Lord has not denounced? For from the top of the crags I see him, from the hills I behold him. Behold the people dwelling alone, and not counting itself among the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob, or number the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the upright, and let my end be like his.
Okay, so if you're Balak and you hear, how can I curse whom God has not cursed? How can I denounce the whom the Lord has not denounced? Did you just get a favorable response from God? What's Balaam saying? Dude, those are God's chosen people. God's saying, those are mine. And you may not curse them because those are my people. And furthermore, who can count the dust of Jacob? What does that mean in verse 10? You're standing on high, looking down at their encampment. Who can count the dust of Jacob? They're so big you can't even number them. It's like sand on a seashore, right? The dust, like they're innumerable. They're huge. So first thing God says is, these are my chosen people. You may not curse them, okay? Now, what do you think Balak's response is going to be to this? What did he hire Balaam to do? Curse Israel. And what did Balaam just do? Sorry, dude, I can't, right? Verse 11, Balak said to Balaam, what have you done to me? I took you to curse my enemies, but behold, you've actually blessed them. You did the opposite of what I asked you to do. Must I not be careful to speak what the Lord puts in my mouth? Is Balaam's reply. Look, I can only speak what God told me to speak. I told you this. This was our deal on the front side. I will do whatever I can, but at the end of the day, what God says goes, and I'm just going to repeat what God says. So 14, you see this persistence of Balaam. Well, maybe God didn't answer this way. Maybe we just need a new vantage point, okay? Verse 13, Balak says to him, let's build another place. Let's go to this other place, although you will see them from an extreme end and will not see all of them and curse them there for me. So Balak's idea is, let's just move. Let's go to a different mountaintop and get a different vantage point of Israel. And then let's build, in verse 14, seven more altars, offer seven more bulls, seven more rams on each altar. Like, this is getting expensive fast, right, and cumbersome. So round two, they change locations, and in verse 18 and following, here's the word of the Lord that they get. Read that.
Rise, Balak, and hear. Give ear to me, O son of Zippor. God is not a man that he should lie, or a son of man that he should change his mind. Has he said, and will he not do it? Or has he spoken, and will he not fulfill it?
What does that mean in context? I already told you. Do you think I'm going to change my mind because I'm looking at a different Israel from a different point of view? Like, come on, Balaam. You know better. Keep rolling.
Behold, I received a command to bless. He is blessed, and I cannot revoke it. He has not beheld misfortune in Jacob, nor has he seen trouble in Israel. The Lord their God is with them, and the shout of a king is among them.
All right, so we'll kind of skip through the rest of this, but the idea is, this is a mighty people. I've already made up my mind. I'm not going to somehow move from a curse to blessing them. That's not going to happen, right? Verse 24, he goes on to describe Israel like this. Behold, a people rises like a lioness, and a lion, and as a lion lifts itself, it shall not lie down until it devours its prey and drinks the blood of the slain. This is describing Israel, who's about to go into battle with whom? Balak, right? And what does God say about them? He's not going to lie down until he's devoured you and licked the blood of his slain. You're going down. They're going to deal with you, and there is no getting around it. Like, oh gosh, if you're Balak, what are you thinking right now? Oh, doo-doo, we've got to figure something out, right? They just took down Sihon and Og. There is no stronger army. There are no better kings. We're dead in the water. So Balak is obviously becoming very desperate. The words that he's getting are significant. Balak's obviously upset. Verse 25, Do you not curse them at all, nor bless them at all? Balak replied to Balaam, I told you, man, whatever God says is what I speak. 27, Balak, again, you know, same strategy. Let's try it again. Let's come to another place. Perhaps it'll be agreeable with God that you can curse them for me there. Like, why Balak thinks just a different vantage point is going to change it, I don't know, but that's his idea, okay? 29 and following, now we're in round three. So round one, God basically says they're a blessed people. Round two, God basically says, look, they're a mighty people. They're going to beat you in war. Round three, now we'll see what he says. Okay, so seven more altars in verse 29. Balak did just as Balaam had commanded in verse 30. More bulls, more altars, more rams sacrificed. And in verse now three and following, listen to this. The oracle of Balaam, the son of Peor, the oracle which of the man whose eyes is open, the oracle in verse 4 of him who hears the words of God, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down, yet having his eyes uncovered. Verse 5, how fair are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel, like valleys that stretch out, like gardens beside the river, like aloes planted by the Lord, like cedars beside the waters. I mean, you're getting this imagery of how God is painting Israel as lush, as fragrant, as strong, like cedars next to water, right? Water shall flow out from his buckets. His seed shall be by many waters. I mean, you're getting, again, a description of Israel's strength. And basically, round three ends the same way round one and two did, which is they're not cursed, they're blessed, and they're exalted because of their qualities. Verse 10, you can see again Balak's response. His anger burns. He says to Balaam, I called you to curse my enemies, but behold, you have persisted in blessing them these three times. Therefore, verse 11, this had to sting a little bit for Balaam. Read that in verse 11. Ouch. So whose fault is it that I'm not giving you a paycheck today? God's fault, right? That's who Balak blames. Look, I was going to pay you. I told you I would richly honor you, but your God has withheld blessing from you because he has not allowed you to curse them, okay? Verse 12 and following, we continue to see this dialogue, and now we're going to see now round four, the fourth and final round of this back and forth with Balak and Balaam and God, okay? Now 15 in following describes round four. Some of it is just very simply a reiteration of what we've seen in the past with Israel strong and they're undefeatable. Some of it is even prophetic. Okay, it's kind of cool to see what God says in regards to Israel. Okay, pick up in let's see, verse 17. This is God describing Israel. Pick up in 24:17.
I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob. A scepter shall rise out of Israel.
All right, stop there for a second. A star shall come forth from Jacob, which is Israel. A scepter shall rise from Israel. When's the last time that we've seen a prophecy like this? It's talked about a ruling staff that will come out of Israel. Genesis, very good. Genesis 49, when Jacob was on his deathbed, he told Judah, the fourth son, there will be a ruler that will come from you, right? He will have a scepter, the king's ruling staff. There will be a kingly line, Judah, that originates from you, okay? What does this mean? I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. What does that language mean? Is this a here and now utterance? No, it's saying in the future, right? Not now, but I see him, a star, a prince, if you will, something significant, a scepter shall come from. This is prophetic, even it seems, of Jesus in the line that he's going to come from Judah, from these kings. And then there's this right now aspect of it at the end of verse 17. And shall crush through the forehead of Moab, King Moab, Balak, like right now. They're coming with a ruler staff, and they're going to crush your forehead, and they're going to tear down all the sons of Sheth, okay? If you look on your map for Sheth, you won't find it. Sheth is not a place. It is a term that means uprising. So basically, God is saying all those that are parts of the sons of uprising that are disobedient to God and are going to walk contrary to him, you're going to be put down, just like you, O king of Moab, okay? And he goes on from there to describe the people that they're going to deal with and how this is all going to end. But end of verse 24, so they all shall come to destruction. That is what God says. So four times Balaam has sought to curse Israel so that he could get his paycheck from Balak. Four times God says, man, they're my chosen people. They're mighty. You're not going to touch them. They're going to win the game. Regardless of what aspect you look at them from, what mountain you stand on to observe my people, they are innumerable, and you better get ready because a whooping's coming. Okay, that's basically what we have seen. So, verse 25, Balaam arose, departed, and returned to his place, and Balak also went his way. So what's the end result of all this? Does Israel get cursed? Nope. Does Balaam get paid? Nope. What's Balak thinking? I'm hosed, right? I just need to get inside my turtle shell and take it, because here it comes, okay? 25 is a very odd chapter. Israel can't be defeated from without. So how would you defeat Israel if you were really, really smart? From within. Chapter 25. Pick up there.
Now, Israel remained in Acacia Grove, and the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab.
Okay. Yours says in Acacia Grove in 25:1?
A-C-A-C-I-A.
Sweet. Okay. Shittim is the way that is pronounced, by the way. Don't pronounce it like my buddy Nick Wrighton did in our residency program. Okay. Shittim. Okay. Guys from the South, man, I tell you, it's amazing. Epic. I mean, that was like 20 years ago, and I remember it like it was yesterday. The pastor's like, Shittim. It's Shittim. Okay? Lovely, right? So funny. Sorry. Every time I see that word, I can't help but giggle inside. So Israel is camping, okay, where I just showed you guys, in the plains of Moab, in that area. And it says they began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab. Verse 2, keep rolling.
They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel was joined to Baal and Peor, and the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel.
So what happens in verse 2? What does this mean? That they invited the people to sacrifices of their gods, and they ate and they bowed down to their gods. And we're talking about Moab, the people that are about to go do battle with. What happened? They intermingle with them. So what's gone on? What have the people of Moab done? They've invited them to church, right? They've invited them to their worship service. So you've got a group of people that have been wandering in the desert for 40 years, and they say, hey, why don't you come hang out with us? Let's have a buffet. Let's, you know, we're going to battle. Let's worry about that later. Why don't we hang out, okay? And from the little that I've told you thus far, I've described a little bit about their worship services. Let me just read for you a little bit about the gods that they worship, right? Moab's main god is who? Do you guys remember his name? Not Molech, that's the other one. Chemosh, okay? That is the main god. And I think somebody mentioned him the other day. I forget what context we were in. Anyway, but that's the god who, his arms were extended, and you would heat his arms with fire. And during times of distress, you would lay your firstborn child in his arms as a sacrificial offering, okay? That's Molech or Chemosh. They're both the same. They're called different things by different tribes. Moab worships Chemosh, but the way you worshiped was the same, okay? We see here mentioned in verse 3, so Israel joined themselves at Baal of Peor. Baal means Lord or Master, okay? And this was, Baal was also a god that was worshipped. Let me read you a little bit about the history of Baal, as well as Asherah, so you kind of understand the context of what we're talking about. And this is important as you think about what's happening in the land and where we're going, okay? By the way, this is some of our pre-Israel reading that we have folks read as before they go, but it's fascinating, okay? In regards to Baal, okay, the earliest deity recognized by the people of the ancient Near East was this god of Baal, okay? His mistress, the fertility god, was Asherah, okay? So when you see the Asherah poles or Ashtoreth, same person, okay? Asherah gave birth to many gods, including the most powerful name. The most powerful god was Baal, okay? So she is the mother of all the gods, and one of those gods is Baal. Not only was Baal the son of Asherah, they were also lovers. Okay, this is the belief in the society. Okay, so Baal basically becomes the most dominant god of all the gods that Asherah gave birth to, and then they became lovers. Okay, and they were worshipped. I'm trying to skip through some of this stuff. Okay. As such, okay, let me read you a little bit about Asherah so you can understand kind of what the contexts are with her. Okay, she was honored as the fertility goddess in the various forms and various names. The Bible does not actually describe the goddess, but archaeologists have discovered figurines believed to be representations of her. She is portrayed as a nude female, sometimes pregnant, with exaggerated features that stand out, apparently as symbols of the fertility she promises her followers. Okay, so the belief was Baal and Asherah were in charge of all the fertility of the land. So if you wanted crops to grow and those sorts of things, again, they were absolutely integral in this process. Okay, Baal's worshippers appeased him by offering sacrifices, usually animals, sheep, and such, like we just read, at these times of sacrifice. And again, in crisis, they would offer up children and so on and so forth. Okay. Asherah was worshipped in various ways, including through ritual sex. Although she was believed to be Baal's mother, she was also his mistress. Pagans practiced what's called sympathetic magic, meaning they believed that they could influence the gods' actions by performing the behavior they wish the gods to demonstrate. Okay, this was their nature of their worship service. Okay, believing the sexual union of Baal and Asherah produced fertility, their worshippers engaged in immoral sex to cause the gods to join together, ensuring a good harvest. The practice became the basis for religious prostitution that we'll see in the Book of Kings. The male priest of their day represented Baal. The female priestess was the temple prostitute, and they would basically get together publicly, do these lewd acts as people would watch and cheer to celebrate the coming harvest and hope that Baal and Asherah would now mate and fertilize the land. Okay, that's church for them. Okay, so when we see here in Numbers 25, the Moabites inviting them in to come worship with them, what are they inviting them to? A gigantic, lewd, forgive the word, orgy. Okay, that's what this is. Okay, so what is Balak's plan at this point? I can't defeat them externally. I can't curse the people. Maybe I can just get them to shoot themselves in the foot. And what happens? So, verse 3, Israel joined themselves together at Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. So they are weary, they are tempted, they are sucked into this offering, and they now are basically have imploded from the inside. Watch now God's response in verse 4. And notice, by the way, who is involved in this action. Take who? The leaders of the people. Why would you take the leaders of the people? Examples. Why? Because they were going. Because they were involved in this. They are actively participating in the worship, like I just read, in the same way of the Canaan or the Moabites' God. The leaders of Israel. Okay? Moses said to the judges of Israel in verse 5, each of you slay his men who have joined themselves to Baal of Peor. So God says, execute the men of Israel who have actively participated in this, the leaders of Israel, right now. Okay? Verse 6, as this is going on, I want you to see just the high-handed rebellion that's happening right now. Verse 6, behold, as this is happening, one of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman, idea being one of the women that's from this area that worships a false god, in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel, why they were weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting. So while God is executing these leaders and showing justice based on their action, there is a guy now that says, I want this Midianite woman basically to be my wife, and he's going into his parents' tent to consummate this relationship. Okay, look at verse 14. They're going to die, by the way. We'll skip to that part in a second because death is awesome. The name of the slain man of Israel was Zimri, the son of Sulu, a leader of his father's households among the Simeonites. The name of the woman who was slain was named Cosby. So you've got a leader now, a kid from Israel. His pops is a leader with this other woman, and they are in high-handed rebellion, say, why God is now executing judgment. We are going to continue in sin while there is a public display of God's judgment. Okay, are you seeing the picture that's going on right now? It's gross immorality.
So when they talk about Baal, so there's no actual life to, so it's not a demon spirit or something like that. Because when they talk about false gods, mm-hmm. it could be two separate things, right? An idol, physical
yep.
metal something,
yep.
or a demonic spirit that they're
right. It's a good question. Asherah was a pole that was worshipped. Baal was represented in different forms, sometimes a goat's head with a human body. So you see that imagery in the places that they worship. But yeah, the question behind that is, what are they, right?
Yeah.
Is the golden calf just a brick of gold? Or is it demonic in some sense, right? We know from Scripture, and as you put your theology of demons together, anything that's not of the Lord is demonic in the sense of that worship. So in one sense, you see... God speak of idols and basically say, man, they're nothing. They're a moment ago, this was a log that you carved into an idol that now you are worshiping, but it's a log. There is power behind some of these things. You look at Israel or Egypt's gods, rather, and they were able to do things. Their magicians were able to do things. Where is that power rooted in? It's satanic. Okay, it's either God or Satan. I mean, there's not other options. It's demonic. At some point. Now, I'm not one of those that thinks that there's a demon in every bush, behind every tree, and that it's just not my theology. But that power, if there is power there, has to be sourced somewhere. Satan is the prince of the power of the air. I mean, he's given rule and authority by God to exercise his reign, in a sense, not as a king, but is over this earth. So there is power there. So I don't think he did. I think it is a superstition of the people that, hey, we live in this incredibly lush land. Why is that land incredibly lush, by the way? Because it's God's land, okay? And they realize that it's being blessed based on what they see around them. Their land is fertile, and they came up with a rationale as to why it was that way. It was also very convenient for them that they liked, right? Well, hey, how about we have, what if we go just beat our heads on a wall for an hour and a half, and that's our worship service? Well, no one's going to come to that. Okay, well, then how about we just have sex with everybody publicly. Okay, right? So it's very convenient. I'm sorry to be so crass, but that's the idea. So it was very convenient for them. And God basically, the temptation for Israel was interesting in that God had taken care of them in the wilderness. Again, we talked about this before, but they weren't sure that their God was a God of the fertile lands, right? Their God's a God of the desert. Can God provide for them in the land? Well, when you get into the land, you see the produce of the land, and the people say, well, man, how do you have this awesome produce? Well, we worship this guy named Baal. We worship this guy named Asher. We've been here for years. Here's the produce of the land. If you want this, who do you need to worship? Our God. So let us show you how. So that is my estimation. No, I think Baal's a stick at the end of the day, okay? But there is belief and power behind that, okay? So, again, the picture is, God is saying execute the males that have taken part of this. They are guilty, the leaders of Israel. You got a guy that's in high-handed rebellion. And then in verse 7, one of my favorite guys in all of Scripture. This guy is bad. We need a male to read verse 7 and following. This is the reaction when he sees in verse 6, this Midianite woman and this guy from Israel, Zimri, walk into a tent to basically, it seems like, consummate their rebellious act, if you will.
Now when Phinehas, the true son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he rose from among the congregation and took a javelin in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel who into the tent and thrust both of them through the man of Israel and the woman through her body, and so the plague was stopped among the children of Israel, and those who died in the plague were 24,000.
24,000 people die. So Phinehas, the son of Eleazar. Who's Eleazar? Moses' son. He's the high priest. So his kid, Phinehas, is the grandson of Moses. He sees what's going on. What does he say? Oh, heck no, is what he says. And he walks into the tent with a javelin, with a spear, and it says he pierces both of them through. Can you get an idea of the position that they're in, that you could shish kebab two people at one time? They are literally in the act of rebellion. And he says, you will not do this on my watch, and kills them both in the midst of what's going on. And God was pleased by his actions. Why? Why would God be pleased with that? What is Phinehas doing? Yeah, he's taking a stand and saying, we're going to worship God, and this is not right. We're putting down the rebellion, and it's exactly what he does, okay? I challenge people every year. I'm like, I dare you to name your kid Phinehas. I mean, this guy is, you're going to see him a couple more times in Scripture, and it's just like this. He is a bulldog, ears pinned back, eyes wide open, frothing at the mouth. Like, he is ready to be on God's team, and if you're in his way, dude, look out, okay? We had a guy in here that went through the program years ago, and they lost their newborn son. It was a horrible circumstance. They had literally days with their son, and their son died. And they named him Josiah Phinehas, right? Josiah is one of the greatest kings in the history of Israel. We'll get to him when we get there. And his middle name was Phinehas. And at the funeral, Jared, Dave Obwald, and myself all got to go, and they asked us to share the story of the heritage of the namesake of these men in terms of what they wanted ultimately their kid to be like. It was really cool. So neat to see that that was their idea, but that was the name that they chose for their kid. So name's still available. It's been used once, but again, this is a neat dude. So Phinehas is, this guy is committed. You never see him waver in terms of his commitment to the Lord. So rough chapter, but this is how God is executing this judgment, okay? Verse 11, the Lord spoke to Moses. I mean, how about, gosh, would you not like this written about you? Read that.
Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, has turned back my wrath from the children of Israel because he was zealous with my zeal among them, so I did not consume the children of Israel with my zeal.
My version says, he was jealous with my jealousy, and he did not. I did not destroy them because I was jealous. What does that mean? He was jealous with my jealousy. What was Phinehas' concern in that moment?
Honoring God.
God's reputation's at stake right now. The glory of God's at stake. Not my name, not my... I mean, you see that this guy spent a little bit of time around his grandfather, right? This humble guy, Moses, that isn't concerned about his name but wants God to be exalted. You see that legacy in this young man who says, we are not going down that way. God is going to be honored, and these guys are going to die as a result, and that's how he saw fit to do it. So this, again, linen, ephod wearing, white bathrobe, priest has to go in and execute judgment. This guy is not necessarily a warrior. He's from the tribe of Levi. They don't fight, but in this moment, he does, okay? Watch this as a result of his actions in 12 and 13.
Therefore say, behold, I give to him my covenant of peace, and it shall be to him and his descendants after him a covenant of everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made atonement for the children of Israel.
How did he make atonement? Well, he sacrificed two people on an altar, basically, is what he did, who were in, right? That was that their sin, their blood, basically atoned for the people of Israel. Okay, so what is God promising as a result of this? Where are the next priests going to come from? From him, right? So don't know how many sons Eleazar has, but the next priest is going to be Eleazar, and then from there will be his kids. So he's going to continue that line. So because of this great response, okay? 14 and following we've read, but God is now frustrated. Now 16 and following, I want you to read, based on what we see here, God's ultimate response. This is, by the way, really, really strong. We do not see this very often in Scripture. This is what God says as a result of this.
Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, harass the Midianites and attack them, for they harassed you with their schemes by which they seduced you in the matter of Peor and the matter of Cosby, the daughter of the leader of the Midianites, their sister, who was killed in the day of the plague because of Peor.
Okay, so the details aren't necessarily mentioned here, but my verse in 17 says, be hostile to the Midianites and strike them. So what is God saying? Are you going to go to battle? Oh, heck yeah, you are. And you're going to exterminate them, by the way. We are going to wipe out this group of people off the face of the earth. We are going to kill every male. Why would God respond so strongly to this? Why would that be his his answer. Turn real quick to chapter 31. The Lord says to Moses, take full vengeance, verse 2, for the sons of Israel on the Midianites, the group of people we were just talking about. Afterward, you will be gathered to your people, okay? Moses says, now take full vengeance on, the time is now, okay? God has waited for some other stuff that we'll get back to and read, but God is now ready to take his vengeance upon the Midianites, okay? Moses gets people gathered for war in verse 3, 1,000 men from each tribe, verse 4, are going to go. Verse 6, Moses sent to them 1,000 from each tribe to the war, and Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the guy that we just read about, right? Goes with the holy vessels and the trumpets, for the alarm is in his hand. What does that mean, that Moses sends Phinehas at the front of this battle with 1,000 men from each tribe of Israel? So they got 12,000 people going to battle against the Midianites, and Phinehas is leading. With, it says, the holy vessels and trumpets. What is this a picture of? What's going on here? Why would Moses specifically mention that Phinehas is going into war with what he's going into war with?
God leading it?
Yeah, it's God leading the war. God's going. The Ark of the Lord is the idea, is going out into battle. You guys remember when the old generation rebelled and they repented and then said, hey, we're going to go up into battle anyway? And Moses says, that's a really bad idea. God's not going with you. And they run straight north out of Kadesh Barnea into the land, and they get spanked and come right back down south, and God was gracious, and they come home. Moses said, the Lord's not going with you. The Lord's going with you here. This is God's battle, and he's going to execute justice based on what he sees, okay? So Phinehas rolls out. They made war in verse 7 against Midian, and the Lord commanded Moses, and they killed every male. Okay, why do you kill every male? You can't reproduce. There is no further generation. Okay, so again, this is strong. We don't see this command by God with the vast majority of the people that they're going to do battle with, but this one they do. Okay, verse 8, look who they kill. Read this list of kings.
They killed the king of Midian with the rule, with the rest of these who were killed, Thebe, Rechem, Zur, Hur, and Reba.
That's a terrible name. That's a king named Reba, dude. That's awful. Reba McIntyre, this guy. So he deserved to die just because he had a bad name. No, I'm kidding. Okay, five kings of Midian and
Balaam, the son of Beor, they also killed with the sword.
What? Who did they kill? Why did they kill Balaam? Balaam did what God said, right? He tried to utter curses, and God said, no, you're going to say this. And he said thus and so to Balak, this is what God told me. They did it four times. It didn't work out, and Balaam went home. Why does Balaam die? Not a Moabite. You're barking up the right tree. He kept trying, right? But ultimately, how does he leave? Defeated, right? He goes, okay, this didn't work. I tried four times, and God was clear. Like, no, 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 no. Like, this is not going to happen, okay? Verse 15. And Moses said to them, have you spared all the women? Behold, these caused the sons of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor, Baal Peor. So the plague was among the congregation of the Lord. What does that mean? Who's responsible for Numbers chapter 25 and the incident we just read in Israel self-imploding? Balaam. What does Balaam do with Balak after he leaves the scene of the four cursings that didn't go well? I got another idea. God won't curse them, but they can shoot themselves in the foot. And here's how we do it. You send in all the temple prostitutes, all the women, and you put on a church service for them, and you show them what they're missing out on. And then you invite them in, and you let them participate in that gross act, but which was even worse than that gross act in God's eyes was what? What are they doing in the midst of that ultimately? They're worshiping a false god, false gods. Baal of Peor, which is the place, but Baal, Molech or Chemosh, right? And Baal and Asherah, right? So they are worshiping false gods. And whose idea was this ultimately? Balaam's. Why? I want to get paid. Rough story, okay? So this guy on the outside, from everything you read up to here, you could go, there's a couple things that seem weird, but he knows the Lord. He seems godly. God's certainly in charge. He gets where his role is and where it isn't, but a rough ending nonetheless. So they kill Balaam, right? So 31 is rough, okay? Now let's read the rest of this chapter, and again, read it for what it is. This is what God says, okay? Verse 7, they made war against Midian, just as the Lord had commanded, and they killed, verse 7, every male. Verse 8, they killed Baal, son of Peor. The sons of Israel captured the women of Midian and their little ones, and their cattle, their flocks, and their goods, and they brought them back alive to Moses. Moses, in verse 7, in 14, was angry with the officers and the captains and said, have you kept the women alive? That's what we just read in 15 and 16. And in 17, this is now Moses' response as to what to do with the women and children.
Now therefore, kill every male among the little ones and kill every woman who has known a man intimately. But keep alive for yourselves all the young girls who have not known a man intimately. And
all right, stop there. So what is the command in 17? Kill every male, right? We saw that. And what else? What do they do with the women? Why would you keep the virgins alive? What does that symbolize based on what we just read?
They weren't the ones that slept with the people.
So how would you distinguish between the people that were worshiping and weren't worshiping? The virgins were not involved in that, so their lives are spared. They were not involved in that idolatry. So Moses says, you may spare them. And ultimately, you may marry them and bring them into your clan if they will follow God. If not, you're going to leave them alive, but they're not to be killed. Okay, so we will have justice or mercy, if you will, with them. But for the women that have known a man, they are to die because they are guilty, and the males are going to die as well because they are guilty, and we're going to stop this line from reproducing because of the sin that has been involved. Okay. 19 and following is just the process of that and how they're going to deal with it, how they're going to cleanse themselves from this. It's a rough chapter in terms of the how they're to do this, but they ultimately get a bunch of bounty from and spoil from this battle. 32 and following, you see these numbers. They got 675,000 sheep, 72,000 cattle, 61,000 donkeys, right? This is what they're going to survive on for a while. So they come in and they do a pretty significant battle. And after they get back from the battle, this is an accounting of all the things that they have, the spoils of the victory, if you will. And in 48, notice this. Pick up there. 31:48. What does that mean?
They didn't kill anybody.
Nobody from Israel dies. So how do you know that this is from the Lord's hand? Not one Israelite dies. 12,001 go with Phinehas, and 12,001 return. So, again, strong language. We see this kind of typical with God of the first is an example. And obviously when we're dealing with this level of misconduct and ultimately worshiping of false gods, this is at the epicenter of who God is, that he will not share his glory, and this is the ultimate cost of what happens here, okay? So back to chapter 26, let's kind of pick up on a couple things that we skipped after the incident at Baal Peor as we kind of finish the book of Numbers, all right? 26 now, we've talked about our big picture divisions. 1 through 10 was preparation to move. 11 through 25, we've been dealing with primarily the old generation. Obviously, the new generation is coming in. At 26 and following now, the old generation's gone. We're just dealing with now the new generation, and we're going to number the people. So God has, in 40 years, killed off a generation, is raising up a new one. So how are we going to do? How many people do we have now that are going to officially go into the land? 26 verse 51, you get a count of the males that are 20 years of age and older who are able to go out and fight battles. This is the number.
These are those who were numbered for the children of Israel, 601,730.
All All right, so we got 600,000 males. You assume we have about that many females. So how many adults do we have going into the land? 1.2 million, right, plus kids. So God has in 40 years completely repopulated Israel, okay? Insane. So 600,000 men, 600,000 women, so 1.2 to upwards of maybe 3 million people that are about to walk into the promised land and cross over the Jordan, okay? So that's the idea, all right? Now, 27 is an odd chapter, not odd in the sense that, well, it's just odd. It's given what we've just read and some of the fierceness of God, we're about to see a very different picture of God in chapter 27. 27:1, the daughters of Zelophehad, these women, their pops is Zelophehad, they come now before Moses. You get all their names at the bottom there. Verse 1, Mala, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. Okay, don't name your kid Hogla, by the way. That's, you're asking for it, right? She's going to get made fun of in middle school. They stand before Moses in verse 2, before Eleazar the priest at the time, at the doorway of the tent of meeting, and they have an issue, right? And they come to Moses in verse 3, and this is their issue.
Our father died in the wilderness, but he was not in the company of those who gathered together against the Lord in the company of with Korah, but he died in his own sin, and he had no sons.
Okay, so what does it mean that he was not among those who died at the company of Korah? What is that referring to? Yeah, the rebellion of Korah, the earth opening up and swallowing all the people that were in rebellion. So they say, hey, he wasn't a part of that rebellion. However, he died in his own sin. What does that mean? What is characteristic of the entire old generation?
They didn't want to go into.
Yeah, they're hard-hearted and disobey. And what do they say? Are they making an apology for their dad or trying to make him look any different? Like, no, look, he didn't die in that rebellion, but his heart is characteristic of the rest of the generation. He died in his own sin, okay? But he's got five daughters and no sons. So, verse 4, this is their issue.
Why should the name of our father be removed from among the families because he had no son? Give us a possession among our father's brothers.
Okay, so what's the issue ultimately? He's promised what? Land. And who does that land go to? Him. And if he dies, to his son. He has no son. So they're saying, hey, why should we not get an inheritance? Just because we're women and we're five daughters, that inheritance is going to get moved to our uncle or that uncle's son, and it's going to get moved ultimately outside of our family. Those dudes are going to marry other people, and we're going to be what? Like, we're going to be out. Like, is that God's heart? Like, God, do you care about women in a day and age where people don't care about women? Women are property. Women are not valued. So is that how God views women, by the way, thousands of years ago? Let's see. Moses brought the case before the Lord and says, God, we've got like a nuance in the law that we've got an issue, right? That it seems inconsistent with who you are, but the law says one thing, but I think your heart's another. Okay? Watch what God says in verse 7.
Zelophehad spoke what is right. You shall surely give them a possession of the inheritance among their father's brothers and cause the inheritance of their father to pass to them.
Huh. So what does God say? They're right. They deserve an inheritance. I care about the women, right? Even in a society that doesn't, God is progressive. He's, dare I say, liberal in the way he's handling some of these affairs. In valuing what he values. And he says, yes, the law says this. This is an exception. These women deserve to be valued because they're valuable. So I will give them the inheritance. They are right. He says to Moses, where did I just go? There it is. He gives some restrictions. Where is it? Transfer the inheritance, goes to the daughter, and then he goes further on to say, hey, if this happens again, if a man dies and has no son, in verse 8, you shall transfer the inheritance to his daughter, not the uncle first or that way. If he has no daughter, then he shall give the inheritance to his brothers. So he just put the daughter above the brother or the uncle, however you're looking at it, that would normally get the inheritance. So he has raised the value of women. If he has no brothers, in verse 10, give it to the inheritance to his father's brothers. So they're getting bumped up, okay? He's going to tell them later. It's not here, but I think at the end of end of Numbers. Yes, 36. In order to keep that land within the family, they have to marry within their family. So if the daughters of Zelophehad are from one tribe and they marry a dude from another tribe, what happens to their inheritance? It gets transferred to the male. So they say, okay, hold on. Yes, it's yours, but stay within your family when you marry. Okay, marry from your tribe so that that inheritance will stay in the land that was supposed to be allotted. Okay, does that make sense? So that's the nuance in chapter 36. Yeah.
So if the land is going to the daughter without her being married, does that nullify the need for like a redeemer kinsman?
For these gals, in a sense, yes. God is their kinsman redeemer. Yep. So he's made sure that they have that issue taken care of. Yeah, because they're virgins. Still marryable. Okay? Make sense? So I think it's a really cool picture of sometimes we don't see God this way. And in a culture that this would have been very contrary to the accepted view of women during this time, and that is not God's heart. And again, guys, this is thousands and thousands of years ago that God took this stance to say, no, we have different roles. We have different responsibilities. Men and women are not the same, but there to be valued. Okay, so I appreciate that this is God's heart in the midst of the law.
I'm trying to remember where, but isn't there a passage that talks about if a man dies and he doesn't have any sons, then a brother would come in to marry, try to bear children,
correct,
one of those being his son, to provide inheritance for the wife? Would that also play a role in the situation?
Yes. Yes, so that's it's in Leviticus. That's the exact story we see with Boaz. That's his job. So he's trying to raise up a family. I think the difference being with that, we're talking about what happens to a widow versus what happens to a virgin. So these women were marryable to anybody because they're still virgin daughters. Ruth, and that specific law with the kinsman redeemer says, you've now got a widow. How do we take care of them properly? So the brother of the deceased husband would come in and say, okay, I will take you as mine. I will give you an offspring. I will raise up a male child from you so that all your inheritance goes to him and your line stays there. So that was his job. Does that make sense? So that's the difference. Virgin versus widow. Okay? So, cool story. Okay? Now, 12 and following, we now see the baton is getting ready to get handed now to Joshua. And God is going to predict what's about to happen with Moses. Okay? 27 verse 12.
Now the Lord said to Moses, go up into the mount of Abram and see the land which I have given to the children of Israel. And when you have seen it, you also shall be gathered up to your people, as Aaron your brother was gathered in the wilderness, during the strife of the congregation, you rebelled against my command to hallow me and at the waters before their eyes.
Okay, so God says, you're going to die. You're going to go up the hill. Mount Pisgah is where they're going to go, Mount Nebo. You're going to die just like Aaron did on the top of a mountain. And 14, you see a very succinct summary of why Moses isn't getting let into the land. What does God say in verse 14? Because you failed to treat me as holy. You shared credit, ultimately, for a job that was mine. You did not provide the water. I provided the water. You are a tool. You turn on the spigot, and that's it. I bring the water. Okay, so he took responsibility, and ultimately, God has not changed his mind. He's not relented, right? He loves Moses. He's forgiven Moses, but the consequences of Moses' sin are still there. Okay, Moses spoke to the people. It says, great. Verse 18, take Joshua, the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him. I want you to see Moses' appointment of Joshua. And why he does this, this is fascinating. Look at verse 19 and following. So beginning, he lays his hands on him again in front of all the people. Verse 19, keep reading.
Set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation and inaugurate him in their sight. And you shall give some of your authority to him that all the congregation of the children of Israel may be obedient. He shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire before the Lord for him by the judgment of the Urim at at his word they shall go out, and at his word they shall come in. He and all the children of Israel with him, all the congregation.
All right, so what do you notice about this appointment of Joshua? Why would Moses do it the way he's doing it? Make some observations.
He's kind of passing his authority, like, in front of everybody.
In front of everybody. Why is that important? No confusion of who the next guy is, right? This is God's chosen guy. I'm going to die, and you're going to... This is the guy you're going to follow, right? So there's no confusion. That's great. A great leader, right? Willing to pass the baton and give credit and basically pass that baton to another. Okay, gives him authority, gives him responsibility. What else do you notice in verse 21? Who's going to be a part of Joshua's ruling process, if you will? The priest, right? The priesthood is still there, and he has to be accountable to them in some way, right? They're going to work together, as Moses and the priest did. So he's not some freelance leader doing whatever he wants. He's got a structure, and there's accountability. And yet, in the midst of that, all the people know who he is and that he's going to be the guy that's going to continue to lead Israel. Now, this doesn't happen yet. We don't see this till the end of the book of Deuteronomy, but this is coming, and Moses is a great leader in that he is transitioning out of his leadership position well. Exalting the next leader in front of the people, saying, this is your guy, I believe in him, God believes in him, this is who you're going to follow, right? And that's a lot of shoe to fill, if you will, right? 40 years leading in the wilderness, these people are frustrated with Moses, but man, God speaks to him face to face. He's a big deal. So Joshua's got a hard job. Now, Joshua, we're going to see, is a very, very different type of leader than Moses, okay? Good in his own regard, but Joshua is great, and he doesn't feel like he needs to be Moses. Joshua feels like he needs to be Joshua, and that's what makes him great. He doesn't try to be somebody else in his leadership role, which would have been very tempting to lead like Moses had led, okay? But ultimately a failure, okay? Now, 28 and following is more of a review, okay? Offerings and festivals and more stuff that we've read before that is a reminder to the people. So 28, 29 we won't read, but it's simply a reminder to the new generation of laws that we've already read, but making sure that the new generation says, hey, these weren't given to your fathers, these were given to you. This covenant is not with me and your pops and me and your mama, it's between you and me. Like, you're my people, so you obey these laws, you walk with me, you're accountable for that, okay? And then in 30, we get to an issue of vows and things that you can commit to, right? In Numbers chapter 6, we read about the Nazarite vow and special vows outside of maybe just the normal vows that you could take. And in 30, God's going to bring clarity to how those can be taken. Again, with the idea of proper order and structure of the family in mind. Okay, 30 verse 1. Let's pick up there.
Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes of the people of Israel, saying, this is what the Lord has commanded. If a man vows a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth.
All right, verse 2, a man, a male. If he makes a vow, how does God view that vow? Serious, okay, it's binding. Can he break it? No. Can you pop off at the mouth and promise something as a dude and say, oh yeah, you know what, sorry, I had too much coffee that day and just got really fired up, but I don't. It's tomorrow now, and I don't want to do that anymore. God says, no, you're bound to that vow, so your word is your bond, right? James says in the New Testament, let your yes be a yes, let your no be a no. So God takes a male's word very seriously. You do not have the ability to back out of a vow, okay? Now he's going to deal with females, verse 3.
Says nothing to her, then all her vows shall stand.
What does that mean? So, first of all, can a woman make a vow to the Lord? Absolutely. Okay. What's the caveat?
The father can negate it or stop the vow.
Exactly. Why?
Make sure it's not a crazy vow.
Okay. Potentially. Not that guys can't make crazy vows. Guys say probably plenty more stupid stuff than women, right? I being one, I'm a first-hand example of that. Why is this mentioned?
She's under his
She's under his authority, right? So if dad says, you know what? Sweetie, I love you. I think that's a bad idea. You're 14, and I know you've made a vow to move to Moab. You're not going to do that. I love you, and I am negating that vow. Okay? That's the idea. So if he thinks he's doing something that is damaging to her, that is unwise, that is outside of his desire for his girl, he can negate the vow. If he hears it and goes, okay, okay, then what? It stands because he's given affirmation to it. So she is now bound to that vow. Okay, keep reading. Verse 5.
But if her father opposes her on the day that he hears of it, no vow of hers, no pledge by which she has bound herself shall stand. And the Lord will forgive her because her father opposed her.
All right, so no harm, no foul. Okay, now, verse 6.
If she marries a husband while under her vows, or any thoughtless utterance of her lips by which she has bound herself, and her husband hears of it and says nothing to her on the day that he hears, then her vows shall stand, and her pledges by which she has bound herself shall stand.
Okay, so now we're dealing with a married woman in verse 7, okay, and the husband's interaction. But verse 8, if on the day her husband hears of her vow and he forbids her, then he shall annul her vow, which makes it which she is under, in the rash statement of her lips by which she was bound herself, and the Lord will forgive her. Why is this mentioned here? If a married woman wants to make a vow, what has to happen? The husband has to agree. Why? Under his authority. Okay. What happens if, okay, in our day and age, it's 2015, and my wife, in her quiet time this morning, vowed that we're going to move to Connecticut and go work at an ice cream shop to God. I don't know. But that was her vow, right? And I come home and, hey, honey, I just vowed that we're moving to Connecticut and opening an ice cream shop. Am I leading the family anymore? No. Like, I am now following my wife. So that takes me out of the position that God has called me to lead our family. Now, if I say, honey, that's freaking brilliant. I think that's what God wants for us. I think I do like 31 flavors, and we're going to go to Connecticut, and we're going to open an ice cream shop. I think that's what God wants. Then what happens? Then I'm bound to it, right? I've got to do it, right? I can't back out. But I am agreeing with what God is doing through my wife. We're saying, honey, man, I think we're supposed to be like less Connecticut and ice cream and more Fresno and bikes. I think that's what God wants for us right now, right? So, no. Let's talk about it, right? So I have the ability to negate that vow because of the order, not because she's lesser than or can't make a vow or, but again, it goes back to that order that God created in the family to make sure there's a check and balance system that the men can lead, the women can be respectful. And it's not that a gal doesn't have great ideas. It's not that a gal may say, hey, honey, I think we should do this. And they can come together and say, absolutely, right? So that is the idea, okay? So the husband ultimately has that authority, just like the father does. There's still that issue of authority. And who, by the way, is the husband underneath? He still has to submit, right? He's not some freelance whatever. He is called to submit to the authority above him as well. So, again, a great picture of God giving incredible liberties and freedoms and blessings to women, and yet still maintaining the structure that started way back in the garden, that they would obey and walk in for ultimate health. Okay, so 30 is just more on that. Okay, husband can, verse 12 talks about him negating that. We've read that, and forgive her, and God's all good with that. So 30 talks about that. Okay, 31, we've read most of it. Okay, that's the rest of Baal Peor and the battle that occurred there, and the death, obviously, of Balaam. 32 now, we're moving into the land. Okay, so let me show you another map here in just a second. Let's pick up in 32, verse 1, and let's watch now as they have defeated everybody. They're on the footsteps of the Jordan River, and they're getting ready to cross over. We get a request from a group of people.
Came and said to Moses and to Eleazar the priest, and to the peace of the congregation.
Skip all those guys' names, okay? Four.
The lamb that the Lord struck down before the congregation of Israel is a lamb for livestock, and your servants have livestock. And they said, if we have found favor in your sight, let this lamb be given to your servants for our possession. Do not take us across the Jordan.
So what are they asking? We want to stay here on the east side of the Jordan, okay? The purple area on your map. Ladies, there's probably another color that I don't know the name of. That's actually what that color is. And that's green, okay? Purple and green. Maybe teal. I don't know. I'm learning. Okay? They're asking for that area. Hey, this is a great land for livestock. We just defeated a bunch of people with livestock. We are herders of livestock. Can we stay here? Now, where was God's original plan for them all to go? Inside the land. Now, if you're Moses, how do you think he's going to respond? What the heck is wrong with you, right? And that's what he says. Verse 6, Moses said, what the heck, Gad, and to the sons of Reuben, shall your brothers go to war while you yourselves sit here? Really? You want to sit on the east side of the Jordan while your brothers go to war? They just fought for you and defeated all these peoples. It was all 12 tribes that did this, and you're going to now take advantage of that and not go into the land and do your job to be with your brothers and to fight as God's wanting, right? Verse 9, they kind of walk through that. The Lord's anger burned in that day. Watch, he's going to go back in verse 8 and compare this to something. This is what your fathers did when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. What is God referring to when he sent people to Kadesh Barnea to see the land? The spies. The spies came back and gave a report. And what did the people do? Oh, God, we can't go to the land. We're all going to die. And he's equating this action to this, saying, you're committing the same sin of disbelief and you're going to not rally into the cause as your fathers did. And he says, man, verse 10, God's anger burned in that day. He was hot mad. And he goes into this dissertation and basically says, man, 14, now you have risen up in your father's place a brood of sinful men to add still more to the burning anger against Israel. How does Moses feel about this? Dude, he's like at a 9.8 right now. He is about to blow his lid. He cannot believe what they're asking. Now, thankfully, verse 15 and following, verse 15, he says, you're going to turn away from following him. He's going to abandon you in the wilderness. Like, he's equating all this to the same. Verse 16, I want you to notice how these men respond, okay? They do not respond in anger. They do not get overly emotional. Watch in 16 what they say.
Then they came near to him and said, we will build sheepfolds here for our livestock and cities for our little ones. But we will take up arms ready to go before the people of Israel until we have brought them to their place. And our little ones shall live in the fortified cities before or because of the inhabitants of the land. We will not return to our homes until each of the people of Israel has gained his inheritance.
So what was Moses' assumption as to why they wanted to stay on the east side of the Jordan? Y'all don't want to fight. And what are they saying? Oh, no. We want to fight. In fact, we're going to go fight. In fact, we're going to build our sheepfolds. We'll leave our sheep here. And when we're ready to go to battle, we're going to battle. Absolutely. And we will not come home until everybody has done their job and we have done what God has asked us to do. That's a great question. Benjamin's got the best fighting reputation. They are they're SEAL Team 6, but I think their tribes are bigger, if you will, because of the double blessing from Joseph. So yeah, they definitely needed them, and they've got a lot more people. So their request is more of a logistics thing. Like, there's a bunch of us, and we got a bunch of sheep. This makes sense, Moses. You mean with Abraham? Right.
Well, when I was talking about two different people. But when Abraham came down, the place that he came from, they trained their men.
Yeah.
So he trained his servants.
Absolutely. I think that's continued in some way. They've got a bit of that warfare training. Now, obviously, they've been slaves for 400 years.
Yeah.
So I think at this point, it's probably... they're probably not trained like Abraham's men were, right? And the Sumer culture and that sort of thing. But there's a grip of them. So this is like a, we've got numbers on everybody. So they're not skilled in warfare per se. Now they're going to get there underneath Joshua's tutelage. So he'll be the guy that's going to train them, if you will. Okay. So they say, look, we're in, we're all in. We're not backing out of a commitment. We're not trying to not do something. And Moses, as a good leader, goes, okay, I was wrong. I thought you guys were being cowards. I thought you guys were not trying to ante up and back out of your commitment. And if that's not the case, verse 20, read that.
So Moses said to them, if you will do this, if you will take up arms to go before the Lord for the war, and every armed man of you will pass over the Jordan before the Lord until he has driven out his enemies from before him, and the land is subdued before the Lord, then after that you shall return and be free of obligation to the Lord and to Israel. And this land shall be your possession before the Lord.
So what does Moses say? I'm down with that. All right. That's cool. That can be your land. So the purple's yours. No problem. You can have that land, which, by the way, is not a great piece of land. It's not like, you know, they were in Carmel going, dang, right? See, beauty, right? It's rocky. It's hilly. It's hot. I mean, it's not. They weren't after the best part of the land. It just made logistical sense, okay? But verse 23.
But if you will not do so, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out.
So what does he say? If you don't do it, what's going to happen? God knows, right? Worst bumper sticker I've ever seen in my life on a car in Denton, Texas, said Numbers 32:23, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. Like, wow. I wonder what a non-Christian thinks when they read that from a Christian's bumper sticker. Like, literally, I wanted to take a Sharpie on the guy's car. Like, golly, don't ever put that on your car. I will slap you, and I won't even warn you. I'll just backhanded slap you and then make you rip it off your car. I'm done. He does. He just doesn't get what he would have. He gets a smaller inheritance. So Simeon gets stuck inside of Judah because of Simeon and Levi's brutality in Genesis 34. Reuben should have gotten the lion's share, but because he slept with his pop's concubine, doesn't get what he would have. But they all still get land. They get inheritance. It's just not what it could have been. Judah's the guy that gets a grip of land. Now, Judah's land kind of stinks too, to be honest with you. It's hot and it's down south, so Israel's very divided, not topography, but just like the vegetation and all that. So Judah gets a lot, but it's like a lot of, hey, man, we got some desert down south in California that we'd love to sell you, right? It's like, oh, okay, it's cheap by the acre, but man, it ain't nice. Nobody wants to live there. So anyway, but yes, they all still get their inheritance. It's just not what it could have been, okay? So Moses says, man, game on. I'm with you. So sorry, I jumped the gun. I was wrong. If you go fight, great. God will indeed give you that land, all right? So that's the rest of it. Okay, 33, chapter 32, verse 33, pick up there.
So Moses gave the children of Gad to the children of Reuben and half the tribe of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, and the king.
All right, you can stop there. The rest of these names are all crazy. Okay, Reuben, Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh, which is actually how you say it. It's Manasseh in our language, but Ronan will make fun of you if you say it that way. They are the three Transjordan tribes: Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh. Where does the other half of the tribe of Manasseh stay? West side. Okay, so that's the idea. So Reuben, Gad, half tribe of Manasseh are the three Transjordan tribes. Transjordan, other side of the Jordan. Okay, you'll hear that terminology. Okay, chapter 33 is the entire 40-year journey of Israel in the wilderness reviewed. So if you want to know every place they camped, every place they stopped, it's all through here. Okay, there are 41 different camping locations in 40 years. So that's how many stops they had. Now, again, God said, look, this could be an overnighter. You could be here a year. You have no idea. The Shekinah glory of God moves. The cloud moves in the morning. You move and you camp. And you wake up the next day. If it's still there, then you stay there. Okay. 41 stops in the Jordan, and we see it all throughout. Okay. Verse 33. They journeyed from Hor HaGidgad and whatever that word is, and camped at Jotbatha or something like that. This location that starts with a J that I can't pronounce is believed to be within like 5 miles or really, really close to where the that temple or the tabernacle model that I showed you that was in the wilderness that they literally built today. They believe that that is right in that location. So they built the tabernacle model that you can go see in Israel today at one of the camping sites of Israel, which is kind of cool. So the rest of these you can read on your own. There was a guy that preached an entire sermon on 3333. So as I was researching that site, I'm like, wow, you pulled a lot from that verse. So apparently it means like good or whatever. So he preached a whole sermon on that town meaning good. I'm sure it was fascinating. I didn't listen to it. Okay, so that's the idea. Now, verse 50, we're going to see this beaten down into Israel. Chapter 33, verse 50, over and over and over and over again. Okay, so let's just start beating it in our heads as well. Verse 50.
Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab up by the Jordan across from Jericho, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you have crossed the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you, destroy all their engraved stones, destroy all their molded images, and demolish all their high places. You shall dispose the inhabitants of the land and dwell in it, for I have given you the land to possess.
All right, so in regards to the people that are in the land, verse 52, what is Israel to do?
Destroy
everything. What about the people?
Drive them out.
Okay. So God's heart wasn't necessarily kill everybody. It was, this is your land, drive them out of the land. And what else? Destroy their figured stones, destroy their molten images, destroy their high places. What is that speaking to? This is all their idols, right? What is a high place? We talked about this a little bit. Yeah, this is where you would, ziggurats are back from Abraham's day, but a high place would have been just literally a hill, but that's where you would have put your Asherah pole, your Baal figurines, right? Your G.I. Joe action figures, and that's where you would go to worship them. So he says, knock them down. Do not leave them there. Destroy their stones, right? Their altars, destroy those. And you're going to see God's going to say, my altars are built this way. Pagan altars are built this way. And there's going to be a distinction. So if you see one that looks like this, destroy it. That's not of me, okay? All their molten images, anything that looks like a golden calf out of Egypt, destroy that. You are not to worship any of their gods. And get the people out of the land. Why would God be so firm on eradicating the people from the land? Yeah. Their biggest danger is what? Self-implosion, okay? If you keep them in the land, what's going to happen? You're going to worship their gods, right? It's not that I don't love those people. It's not that they are any holier than you. It's not that you're better than them. They worship false gods. I do not want you to intermingle yourselves with them. Now, we know obviously God doesn't hate these people because Moses married a Midianite woman, you know, from Midian and worshiped a false god. We see Ruth and other people that are brought in, and God says, man, if you want to worship me, I'll take you all, no problem. Any color of skin, any language, whatever background you have, you're in. I don't care about that, but their gods are what God is concerned about, and he knows the tendency of the people, okay? So that's the idea. So he says, everybody out, all right? Dang it, 7:30. We're going to finish. Watch this. 34, division of the land. I'll show you a map tomorrow. Done, okay? All the tribal allotments, I'll show you on a map and where they fall and who got what, okay? 35, what do we do with the Levites? Here's what we do with the Levites. I'm glad you asked. Verse 6, okay? The cities which you shall give to the Levites, 35:6, shall be 6 cities of refuge. You guys remember talking about those? What were the cities of refuge? Second-degree murder. You accidentally kill somebody, not purposefully kill somebody. Very different. You can go to a city of refuge, and it's basically house arrest for the rest of your life. So the Israelites have 3 of those that are given to them on each side of the Jordan. 6 total. And verse 6, 42 other cities that he scatters all across the nation. So the Levites live everywhere. 6 of the 48 cities are cities of refuge that the manslayers, they're going to be called, can come and have basically house arrest for the rest of their lives and not die if they accidentally killed somebody, right? So you're plowing your field and you run over a dude with your ox. You're like, oh, dang it, I did it. Whoops. You got to run fast, okay? That's the idea, all right? For unintentional sin, okay? 36 we already talked about. That's the inheritance of women. I'll touch on it again tomorrow. But that is the book of Numbers, all right? We'll pick up there in Deuteronomy tomorrow. Come on, that's in a minute. I just covered 3 chapters. You tell Shay he's sorry. He can't even cover 2 chapters in an hour and a half. Cool. All right, we'll see you guys in the morning.